This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's the first Friday of the month, and time for our first weekly news recap of 2024. That's where we dive deep into the top stories across Chicago and Illinois that you need to know about. Stories like these.
The U.S. Census Bureau admits Illinois was undercounted and actually gained residents.
300 new laws are now officially on the books in the state of Illinois.
Pending approval of the state Senate, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services will have a new director.
Advocates trying to block former President Trump from the 2024 ballot are formally objecting to that newly submitted nominating petition.
We sat down with a panel of journalists to break down those stories. Quinn Myers covers Wicker Park, Westtown, and Bucktown for Block Club Chicago. Alex Nitkin is a reporter with the Illinois Answers Project for the Better Government Association. And rounding out our panel is WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp. And we started off by talking about efforts in Illinois to keep former President Donald Trump off the ballot. And I asked our panelists to weigh in. Here's Alex.
We're not used to looking at a presidential race as a legal question before. This is an entirely new question, a new issue. And one thing is that you'd have to think eventually it'll come to the U.S. Supreme Court with all of this kind of swarm of lawsuits that are being appealed and overturned, and it's probably going to go to the conservative Supreme Court. The other thing is that if Donald Trump is convicted of a crime, which is entirely possible this year, that would open up an entire new legal can of worms and I'm sure a set of lawsuits over whether a convicted felon can run mm-hmm. for president.
What do you think, Sarah?
I think, like Alex, look at the Supreme Court, right? That when they get this question, I think one of the state, his legal team already went to the Supreme Court this
Colorado,
week, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I expect that the Supreme Court will side with him just because. And I guess the question is that he hasn't actually been convicted of leading an insurrection, so. There's some question like, is that mean that he didn't actually do it? I'm no legal expert, but if he could get convicted of something, then would that then change the whole scenario, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess we're all sort of thinking that this is just a big old hubbub and does it really mean anything because the wheels of justice roll really slowly and we're probably just gonna wait out until November and there I doubt that there'll be a conviction before
and
November.
Meanwhile, I mean, Trump is trying to just wrap up the Republican nomination as quickly as possible before his court cases come, before all of this stuff gets settled, so basically he can be the Republican nominee before anything comes down.
He filed appeals this week in Maine and Colorado, two states which have blocked him from appearing on the ballot. Now his Colorado appeal will most likely be heard by the Supreme Court, as you mentioned. And this is at a time, Quinn, when he faces many other court dates for more than 90 criminal counts. I mean, do you think that this latest controversy hurts or helps Trump's campaign?
I don't think it really hurts him. I mean, I think his diehard supporters will be supporting him no matter what. I mean, he's facing four indictments, federal and state. So I don't see it impacting him. And in Illinois, I think even if it does go up to the Illinois Supreme Court with a Democratic majority and they do rule, I agree. It's going to come back to the U.S. Supreme Court. It has a conservative majority, probably will side with Donald Trump.
Now, Alex, we've also received confirmation this week that a substantial number of people were missed by the 2020 U.S. Census count here in Illinois. so much so that our state may not be losing population after all. What happened?
Yeah, you know, census counts are a really big deal, not just for sort of clout and reputation, and you hear a lot of political messaging going back and forth. We're losing population. Actually, we're gaining population. Really, it matters in large part because of federal funding, which is a big reason why, if you think back to the 2020 census, all of the local governments in city and state were so invested in get yourself counted. We want as many people to be counted as possible because it really matters for all of us to, you know, get our fair share of federal grant money. And so this is part of this latest episode of this sort of back and forth where the Census Bureau had originally said that we as the state of Illinois had lost several tens of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. The state came back and said, no, actually, we found some more. And then what we're talking about here is the difference between 2022 and 2023. The Census Bureau does periodic updates. The Census Bureau said originally the state lost 30,000 people between just that one year, 2022 and 2023, making it one of eight states in the country that lost population. The state of Illinois has come back. It launched a, you know, investigation. It said, hey, we found 46,400 more people under some couch cushions. I don't know. I don't know how they do these investigations. Just another in this back and forth where the state has come back and now the Census Bureau has acknowledged, okay, you actually gained a little bit of population. I think that this really shrouds some other more important numbers that are a little bit below the surface, like that some parts of the state are actually gaining population very fast, like in downtown and sort of north and northwest side of Chicago, whereas the rural and downstate are really hemorrhaging population, which I think is a much more important nuance of all of this.
Right.
Another piece of it is that later in the Tribune story that reported this by Robert Chanik, should shout out there, the state during this period lost about 84,000 people in net domestic migration of people who left the state to go to different states, but that was partially made up by 41,000 roughly international migrants. So this is also a really important piece of context for the migrant, if you want to call it migrant crisis.
Yeah.
You know, you could call it a problem. Cities and state don't know what to do with all of these people.
So
but
an
ultimately,
undercount is problematic.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if undercount, the state's theory or the state's argument is if you don't count us for the actual number of people who live here, then we're not going to get our fair share of resources that we deserve.
Yeah. And so the living situation, you joked about people being found under couch cushions, but I mean, they talked about group quarters, right? What living situations are considered to be group quarters?
I think some like dormitories, college dormitories. Yeah. People who are incarcerated, I think there was one of the criteria.
Oh, assisted living.
Assisted living, things like that, yeah. And, you know, I think it's always interesting. We had this push and pull with census data. It becomes so political so quickly. People on the right and left use it so quickly to bolster whatever point they're trying to make. Is Illinois growing? Is it declining? Are people leaving the high property taxes? Are they coming here for all the opportunities? It becomes kind of almost meaningless at this point. But it's not, to your point, Alex, because it is tied to federal dollars that the state needs.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We are breaking down the biggest stories in the state this week with a panel of first-rate journalists, WVEZ education reporter Sarah Karp, Alex Nitkin, a reporter with the Illinois Answers Project, and Block Club Chicago's Quinn Myers, who covers Wicker Park, Westtown, and Bucktown. So, Sarah, I want to turn now to some new state laws that went into effect this week. Now, you probably heard about the state's minimum wage increase from $13 to $14 an hour, as well as the assault weapons ban. But we wanted to spend some time on the recap this week on the few lesser known new laws. So for starters, I want you to break down this one. Illinois residents can no longer hit their vapes in public.
Yeah.
They don't let us have anything anymore.
I mean, I guess, who knew?
Right. Wasn't that already? I mean, you go into a bar or restaurant and, you know, you can't vape, right? Or, you know, it was already kind of at least case by case.
Yeah.
Really, I'm not a big vapor.
Clearly.
And I have like no idea what were the rules around this. Though I actually was somewhere not too long ago where somebody was vaping and I was like, I didn't know you could do that inside. But yeah. Now I guess you can't. So.
Well, yeah, e-cigarettes and vapes are
It's public spaces within a certain distance
they're prohibited now in public places and within 15 feet of entrances.
Oh, wow.
That is the new law. Any thoughts, Quinn?
I mean, I think
is this going to impact your life?
It will mostly not. I don't think, I think this is probably a good thing. I mean, if you can't smoke, obviously maybe vapor from an e-cigarette isn't quite as damaging as secondhand smoke. But, if you're at a bar or restaurant and someone's puffing a huge vape cloud next to you, it's a little annoying, I would think. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to require people to go outside similar to how you would smoke a cigarette.
All right, for those of you who will be building new single-family homes or constructing residential buildings with parking in 2024, a new law says that you're going to have to make them EV-friendly. What do we need to know, Quinn?
So last year, the Electric Vehicle Charging Act was passed, basically that will require, starting this week, single-family homes and some smaller residential buildings, I believe it's under 5 units, have to build an electric vehicle-capable parking units per space, essentially, with charging capabilities. And then larger buildings, I believe, in 90 days will now then be required to add in, new buildings will have to add charging ports. So it's a boon for the electric vehicle business, but also I think it's a sign of the times showing that more and more consumers are buying electric cars, and we're going to see more of that down the road.
Yeah. And Alex, there was also a law that got removed from the books this year, and it had to do with things like air fresheners in your car.
You're finally allowed to have an air freshener hanging from your rear windshield in your car. I did not know that that was against the law before.
Yeah, what was the purpose of it?
It's actually really interesting. It was proposed by, or at least supported by, Illinois Secretary of State Alexis Junulius. Mm-hmm. The impetus for this was that he and advocates found that police officers were using this kind of obscure, little-known law against having air fresheners as grounds for traffic stops.
Yeah,
And so this
racially
was
profiling drivers.
We've seen cases where wasn't the young man in Minnesota who was
Philando
killed?
Castile?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because he was stopped originally, wasn't it, because of an air freshener?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's very, very interesting.
We have, a quote from the press release from Junulius that says, there's absolutely no data to support that pulling people over for an air freshener or rosary reduces violent crime or prevents accidents. It seems pretty intuitive, but just sort of an interesting thing to see in an official press release and sort of one way of eating away at this huge issue of using traffic stops as kind of a form of racial profiling.
See, I told you I was going to hit on the laws that nobody really talks about. Well, let's shift here to Governor Pritzker naming a new head to the state's Department of Children and Family Services. Sarah, who's Heidi Mueller?
So she was the head of the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice since 2016. She led a pretty progressive initiative while she was there where, she really, worked on revamping the system, making it more more catered to children and to, rehabilitating them. Mm-hmm. I've certainly heard better things about the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice under her leadership. And so they did a national search and they chose her. One thing that I was, sort of surprised about when I was reading the article in the Sun-Times about her is that this is the 13th director in 14 years. That's a lot.
Yeah.
So, and the Department of Children and Family Services is just perennially in trouble and has had a lot. I mean, even the report that came out before Christmas, in December, it was really, pretty terrible about, kids waiting in, waiting for placements and
sleeping in offices, offices.
And I've heard, this last year I did a story on a state program for kids who have mental health issues. And one of the things that we heard is that if you were a child who was in foster care, sometimes you would go to an emergency room for a psychiatric issue and wind up sitting there for like 2-3 weeks because there's nowhere to place you. And so I just think this is a department that, deals with the most vulnerable children. And, hopefully this director can, finally get some things in place that can work better for kids,
Well, she's the 13th in 14 years.
Yeah, good luck to her.
Good luck. All right, Alex, former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan appeared in federal court this week for a hearing about his highly anticipated corruption trial. Just remind us, as if we need reminders, what is Madigan charged with?
He is charged with 22 counts of various forms of racketeering, bribery. Basically, the way that federal prosecutors put it was that he was essentially a crime boss, that he spent most of his, or at least the last decade of his very long and illustrious career as House Speaker, State House Speaker, as, quote, leading a criminal enterprise whose purpose was to enhance his political power and financial well-being while generating income for his political allies and associates, end quote. They did not pull any punches. Thank you to the, federal prosecutors for putting that into words. So I would not have to try and boil down to a couple of words what the sort of essence and aura and reputation of Mike Madigan. Mm-hmm. This indictment came down almost 2 years ago now, March 2022, and we've just been waiting and waiting for his trial.
Wow.
Time flies, right, when there are so many different political indictments.
Yeah, and at this hearing, Madigan's trial date, which had been scheduled for this spring, it was punted.
Yes, by, we think, about 6 months. We have no way of knowing, of course, that that's going to be the last time this is
delayed. Why did the judge decide to delay?
Because he wanted to wait for a Supreme Court decision regarding a former mayor of Portage, Indiana, James Snyder, who is on trial for similar kind of corruption charges. Apparently, he thinks that there could be some kind of precedent set by that. And so just to be careful, they're going to kick the Madigan trial back until, I think, October of this year is when it's scheduled. We did wait for, I think, 4 or 5 years for the, 4 years for the Ed Burke trial. So the, like Sarah said, the wheels of justice move slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When a date in October, as you mentioned, I mean, that pushes this trial to the heart of election season.
And up to Christmas, just like we saw the Ed Burke trial last year.
That's right.
But, you know, it's obviously in these people's favor to push their trial back as far as possible. They want to, you know, kind of push it out of public memory if they can. And they want to, basically, if they are going to end up going to jail, they want to delay that as far as possible.
We just took a look at what happened at the state level during the first week of 2024. But there's a lot more news to get to right here in the Chicago area, like how CPS principals got news this week that school resource officers might be out of their schools as soon as the fall. Here's Sarah.
There's many parts of this. One thing that I really want to make clear is that only 39 high schools still have principals stationed in them. So
school resource officers.
Right. So we call, you know, that's the formal name of the program, school resource officers. And they, so, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, CPS is removing cops. It's like CPS has been removing, or cops have been leaving the public school system. I mean, you remember in 2020, there was a lot of discussion about police brutality around George Floyd. At that time, there was a lot of activism around trying to remove police officers from schools. Local school councils were given the power to vote, to take them out, and they've been taken out of a lot of schools. So this board is going to have to vote on another contract with CPD coming in August, and there's a lot of evidence that this board will not support that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the school district and board members are trying to just prepare principals. You know, there's a lot of debate about this, but one of the main things that this board members have been concerned about for a long time is that police officers in schools tend to criminalize student behavior, you know, that otherwise might be punished through like suspensions or expulsion.
And that's why proponents wanted to see them out of schools.
There's a lot of evidence that police officers in schools police inside the schools. Whereas when a lot of the discussion about police officers in schools talks about safety from outside the schools. And I think that one thing that the public school, you know, I talked to someone from the public schools this week who was saying, like, we're not going to end our relationship with the police department entirely. They'll still be, you go by high school, a lot of times during dismissal, you will see, a police officer's mm-hmm. car drive by. And I think that will still be.
I see. You mentioned local school councils. give us quick context, the powers that they have and how many LSCs have decided to get rid of officers in the past.
So I think it's about 24 voted to get rid of them. And then a lot of the ones that still have police officers in the schools, rather than have two, they have only one left. They were incentivized because back 2 years ago, they decided that if you remove the police officer, you could get money to hire a counselor or a school resource, a sort of justice coordinator, somebody that would work with kids and discipline otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of schools took that up and did that. So a number have removed police officers from schools already.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, even some of the schools that you would think of, like, oh, well, they're in a dangerous neighborhood. Oh, don't they need police officers? A lot of them don't have them right now.
Now, Mayor Johnson, back when he was on the campaign trail, said, you know, quote, armed officers have no place in schools. But upon taking office, of course, we know Johnson said he was okay with letting the local school councils choose. I'm curious, Alex, since taking office, the mayor has in many ways, we've seen him try to appeal to people who didn't vote for him, right? What do you think a school board decision to cut the police contract would mean for him and how he's perceived?
I don't know. I think that it's definitely no surprise to hear him sort of punt the issue to other jurisdictions or other folks. I mean, this is someone who's being asked every single day for his view on every single thing, which in one way makes sense. He has control, still over the school system and school board in many ways. I think that was probably a pretty natural reaction for now him to say, I have enough on my plate. I have enough actual things that he has really direct power
to. Let the LSCs handle this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's a very diplomatic and political answer. It's also something that, you know, now that the Board of Education has appointees who are really friendly to him and allied with him, is probably a little safer for him to say that he can, you know, feel more comfortable leaving those kinds of decisions in their hands.
Mm. Right. I mean, he knew who he appointed, right? So he knew that he appointed people that would not want police in schools.
Yeah. Well, what's the timeline and next steps for this, Sarah?
I think that what's going to happen is that local school councils will be told you need to create safety plans in your schools that do not include school resource officers. They probably will also tell these schools that they will get money to hire some extra staff instead of those police officers. They'll also open up the floor to some public discussion about this to say they want feedback, but the parameters around it will be that imagine a school safety plan without police officers.
Mm. All right, Quinn, as we know, migrants have been bused and flown to Chicago from Texas since August of 2022, so well over a year at this point. And one hallmark of this is a lack of communication and coordination from Governor Abbott with not just buses, but planes full of people arriving at all hours of the day. Now, Mayor Johnson has begun to put some limits on bus companies. This is in an attempt to try to create some sort of order. But now Chicago suburbs are trying to do the same. They're trying to follow suit. So even in some cases, they're blocking buses from bringing new arrivals in. Fill us in.
Sure. So you'll remember late last year, City Council passed an ordinance basically that would allow the city to fine and in some cases impound these so-called rogue buses from mostly from Texas that were showing up unannounced in the city without prior notice outside of the curfew that the city had established and not at the city's designated landing zone, which is near downtown in the South Loop, where city employees basically can respond, be there, help people find shelter, kind of figure out what their next steps are. So it was creating chaos, and the city put this new rule into effect. There was pretty quickly some immediate fallout. We've seen at least two planes chartered by Texas come. One to Rockford, one to O'Hare, bringing hundreds of people here who are then bused to the city limits or to outside the city and given train passes or other methods of communication to come into the city. We've seen numerous buses drop off in suburbs. This past week, we saw several suburbs and cities respond to that. Joliet, Waukegan, North Chicago, other suburbs passing laws to limit or restrict how buses can drop asylum seekers off in their municipalities without prior warning.
Well, yesterday here on Reset, we talked with Brian Cones. He's the pastor at Trinity Episcopal Church in Highland Park, and they're currently housing 15 new arrivals. But here's a little bit of his response to some of the ordinances that are blocking these unscheduled drop-offs now in the suburbs.
There's no doubt a need to regulate how the buses arrive for people's safety. But regulating versus just blocking people from entering, I mean, that's two different things. Mm-hmm. When we actually have the ability to turn what we keep calling a crisis into a problem that we can solve and eventually, you know, generate some good out of it. New communities, safe people, new economies for Chicago. I mean, I think this could be it's a difficult time, but we could rise to the occasion instead of maybe worrying that there's not going to be enough, or giving into a certain kind of fear about new arrivals.
So you mentioned this overarching worry that there's not enough resources and even, folks' fear of new arrivals. I mean, are you seeing sort of that reflected in the neighborhoods that you're covering?
Sure. I mean, we've seen a lot of backlash across the city over the past year and a half to establishing shelters, temporary shelters for migrants. I mean, in WBZ's Mike Puente's story about this from this week, he interviewed Buffalo Grove Village Board President. He said, there's nothing political about this ordinance. We're just trying to, have some proper provisions and planning here. But of course, it is political, right? It is inherently dictating how and when people can or cannot come into a certain community, right? And that's something the city of Chicago has been dealing with, debating in communities at City Hall for about a year and a half now. I don't know if we're any closer to finding a solution here without any larger authority like the federal government, coming in with a larger, more comprehensive plan and spending.
As you mentioned, the state's funding an intake center to welcome new arrivals at what's known as this landing zone in downtown. People are arriving there. They're sleeping on warming buses while they wait for somewhere to stay. Now, there's also 6 heated tents currently under construction. I mean, can we expect that intake center to be up and running
soon? Yeah. So back in November, the state of Illinois, Governor Pritzker announced that the state would spend $160 million in various parts of the new arrivals mission. And $30 million of that is going to this intake center at the designated landing zone near downtown. Construction has finally begun on that this week. The state told me there are going to be 6 heated tents to take in people and help them either find shelter space in Chicago or continue on to a different destination outside of Chicago. The state and city have said that those efforts will help, not overwhelm the city's shelter system, because a lot of migrants coming here actually don't necessarily want to stay in Chicago. They want to go. They have family and friends elsewhere. They want to go to a different city. But something, as that is being set up this week, we were down there. Block Club was there, and we interviewed a few people who have spent a few nights on CTA warming buses at the landing zone as these facilities get set up. And the intake center is not, a state spokesperson told me, is not meant for people to spend the night there. It's meant to be a temporary place where they can warm up, get some food,
and
keep them moving. So there's still some disorder and still some things being worked out there for sure.
Yeah. You know, one thing I thought was sort of interesting this week, and I'm not exactly sure where I read it, but that the amount that Chicago was predicted to spend on migrants over the last year is way less than we actually spent. And I really was really curious about what was it that we didn't do what we should have been doing for migrants, and that's why we spent so much less? Or was it that the migrants, the things that we thought were going to be expensive were less expensive? But I do think that it's worth digging in a little bit into, like, okay, so why did they think that we were going to spend, I think it was like spend over $300 million, and we really spent only $136 million or mm-hmm. something. Those are the numbers that stand out in my mind. But I think that there's, there's some real questions. I mean, I hear a lot from schools who are getting kids, a big influx of kids. And it's not that these kids don't need resources and teachers and things like that. It's just that they're not there.
Let's shift gears, Alex, to something that impacts all of us. That's transit safety. So while traffic crashes and deaths increase in Chicago, they have decreased in Evanston. So we're talking hundreds in Chicago compared to several years with no deaths for cyclists or pedestrians in Evanston. That's pretty stunning.
It is. We were surprised when we had heard about this, too. We stumbled across a speech that U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg gave about a year ago to the U.S. Conference of Mayors. He was talking about what's called Vision Zero, this concept of all cities should strive to have zero traffic deaths, no people getting killed in the streets anymore because of cars. And he shouted out Evanston. He said, well, there's, you know, you may think that it's impossible, but there's this one city, Evanston, that managed to do the impossible and go 5 years without a single traffic death. And we looked into it.
What are they
doing
right?
It's true. I mean, that is the question.
That is the question. What are they doing?
Trying to figure out.
Yeah.
And it really is a combination of various different strategies that all amount to getting cars to slow down in one way or another. They, multiple times in multiple places, lowered the official speed limit. The city's, or the state's kind of statutory speed limit for roads everywhere is 30 miles an hour, and Evanston has been going kind of arterial street by street and saying, actually, it's going to be 25.
Mm-hmm.
They found that that's made a real difference. A lot of it is also just a really kind of centralized and coordinated and deliberate annualized effort to make the streets safer with infrastructure, by building separated bike lanes, by extending sidewalks and creating just more barriers to cars. If you've been up there and you've seen on Dodge Avenue or on Sheridan Road near Northwestern there, they've completely remade the streets. And I think that the takeaway here really is that there's no new secret sauce. There's no silver bullet. There's nothing that we don't already know about how to make streets safer. It's really just building the kinds of infrastructure that make cars go more slowly and create more space for pedestrians.
And it
cyclists.
Is hard to compare Evanston and Chicago directly, right? As you point out in your reporting, Alex, Chicago is much larger. You know, we've got busy arterial streets and highways crossing the city and much different funding streams, many more decision makers than Evanston, that's for sure, too. But sounds like we can take from what Evanston is doing well.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely true. Chicago is a much, much bigger city. I mean, it also had about 30 times bigger, to be exact. I think that the thing that stuck out to us is that over the past 10 years, Chicago's data has been getting worse while Evanston's has been getting better. And I think that it's just worth pausing on how big a deal it is. The city of Evanston, population about 80,000, went 5 whole years without a single death. It's a really big deal when a single Chicago ward goes a full year without a death. And while, you know, it's definitely true that there are so many different decision makers and funding streams and things like that, that's also, I think, kind of a revelation here, which is that when you have so many different cooks in the kitchen, in particular, older people who have their own actual, not just say in infrastructure spending, but each of them is sitting on their own $1.5 million pot of menu infrastructure spending.
Mm-hmm.
They really have so much latitude over what gets built and what doesn't. And we really were able to describe ways that that was an obstacle.
Well, I got to get reaction from Quinn here to Evanston's model of slowing drivers down, because you've been reporting on the construction of bike lanes at Grand and Milwaukee.
Yes, I mean, Wicker Park, Westtown, Bucktown is kind of centralized. Lots of cyclists, lots of bike lanes. But two projects, really an extensive one that's totally retrofitting Grand Avenue, basically from Chicago Avenue all the way to Ogden, Ukrainian Village into Westtown. There's an ongoing bike lane project there, and there's a similar one with some differences on the so-called hipster highway on Milwaukee Avenue between North and Campbell Street, which goes just past Western, right kind of into Logan Square. Those projects were part of the so-called Complete Streets project, projects that the city has been rolling out over the past few years.
Mm-hmm.
And they have faced a couple delays, but they're going to be wrapping up this spring. But just to Alex's point, you know, lots of cyclists call for a bike grid, something that will basically connect the entire city, and you don't have to kind of go, oh, I'm in the first ward, but now I'm in 32 and the bike lane ends here. And then I have to go back up a street and get on the bike lane again. You know, something that has a cohesive strategy and something that I think CDOT has really been working towards, but that is still lacking a comprehensive plan.
Well, in the vein of alternate transit, got to mention the CTA Yellow Line that connects Skokie and downtown is back up and running. That's after 2 months of inactivity. Now, in mid-November 2023, a Yellow Line train rear-ended a snowplow, injuring dozens of people. Sarah, before we wrap up this portion of the recap, Chicago has moved from low to medium risk of COVID transmission. Now, this is the first time this has happened in a year, and it's on the heels of December being the so-called triple-demic with, you know, high flu and RSV and COVID cases. I mean, have you been hearing of more people getting sick?
Yes.
I certainly got hit with it over the Christmas
break.
You
did? Did you get COVID?
No, it was a flu.
Cold, though. I
took 3 COVID tests and they say I didn't have COVID, but that felt COVID-y.
I had some family members not be able to come to Christmas because of COVID, so that was very sad. Yeah. But
my kids were out for the entire Thanksgiving week.
Just really?
Out, down sick. For the count.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you know what was interesting about the article on this is that the flu is actually more of a concern. The increase is, you know, sort of gone up a lot more for the flu, while COVID and RSV has kind of plateaued. And, you know, they said that's because over the last couple years, especially during COVID, a lot fewer people got the flu because we weren't around each other. And so now, you know, everyone's getting the flu. And also, people aren't getting vaccinated. And the vaccination rates are just really low. Yeah. And I do know that going back into school, you know, kids go back next week, a lot of people are really worried that it's just going to be like, woosha. But one good thing is that the holidays were way at the beginning of Christmas, and I mean of the 2 weeks, and so now the kids have been off for 2 weeks, so you know, maybe they got it out of their system.
Sure hope so. I don't want anyone coming back with anything when they go back next week. Have y'all been hearing about people getting sick lately too?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I had COVID in November, pretty mild, geez. But you know, it's become part of the fabric
it's
of our
a thing
lives.
Now, right? It's part of the rotation. Well, in light of this, Sarah, some medical facilities, including Rush, they're requiring patients and visitors and staff now to put their masks back on.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder, in places like that where, you know, people go there when they're sick, why they don't always want people to wear masks.
Right.
Sometimes I'm sort of like, well,
I'm like, the mask makes sense. Came off?
Right. When I go into, like, a waiting room of a doctor, I would not mind a mask, you know?
I'm pretty sure when I brought my daughter for her annual checkup in November, we were asked to put masks on.
Yeah.
So I don't know where they were doing that, but put your masks back on, please.
And get vaccinated.
And get your booster shots. Yeah. Booster. Yeah. We're not done with boosters, folks. We're not done.
There's still more local news to cover, but with the first week of the new year nearly over, I had to check in with our panelists to see how they're feeling about 2024.
Okay.
Yeah.
good. Feeling good. I feel like I don't know where these 5 days have gone.
Yeah.
Feeling tired.
Yeah. Well,
it's hard coming back.
Anybody tired of their resolution just yet?
Well, the good thing is if you don't make any resolutions, you don't have to.
Yeah, that's
stick
right.
With them.
Yep.
So no resolutions?
Oh, no.
Wow.
You know, just a general, like, you know, plea for self-betterment, but nothing like nothing too specific. You know, I don't want to hold myself to anything.
And where do you start on that journey?
Oof. You know.
For bettering yourself.
Yeah. Everything. More exercise, more sleep, less phone, everything.
Yeah.
Less phone. Good luck.
Less phone. I typically do the vision board thing. Did not do it this year for some reason. However, got the bright idea from a reset guest yesterday to make it less overwhelming and take it in quarters. And so I'm going to do and do a digital version.
Do a little quarterly reports.
Shout out to Jenny
yourself.
LaFleur, Mama Fresh. Yeah, so do a little quarterly, you know.
Kind of like you can file taxes quarterly.
Yeah, so this
like
weekend I think I'm going to sit down. Exactly, I'm going to sit down and figure out.
Your Q1 goals.
How do I want to better myself through till March.
It makes me think about our HR thing that we have, the Lattice. Where they send us these, like, you're semi there.
You're
your
almost
goal
there.
It's like, oh, leave me alone. Yeah.
If anyone's listening from WBEC HR, we didn't mean that.
Sorry.
We didn't mean that. All right, well, something cool happened. We saw the first newlyweds of 2024. It was a couple from Pilsen. So the first newlyweds in Cook County, I should say. Now, I'm curious if anybody here would race to the altar at the start of a new year. Does that sound appealing to you all?
No. Definitely doesn't. So we were just talking a little bit off mic here. I happen to have just gotten legally married in the City Hall basement.
Yay!
Just a couple months ago.
Congratulations.
As sort of a thank you. As kind of just getting the paperwork done precursor to like our wedding so that we wouldn't have to worry about having like a legal officiant, any of that kind of stuff. It was a great, pretty easy experience. I mean, getting the
license.
Wait,
you're not telling us about the basement. You said it involved a basement.
Oh, yeah. That was the best part. So the going in and getting the license is a little bit intensive, but once you have the license, you go into the basement and it's just this sort of like drab like office waiting room with a little window, and there's like a guy in the window. And it's like, are you here to get married? And it's like,
oh, this sounds so sketchy.
It's just, two for one special. It's,
oh my gosh.
No, and then you just go in, and they're like, all right, we got a judge here. Like, all right, do you? I do. Do you? I do. You're married. Congratulations.
That's it's it. Very,
pretty much. I mean,
Sarah, you got married in the basement too, right?
Yeah, and you know, I don't know. They did the vows. Oh, like, do you?
I mean, they said, would you like to take? Yeah. Oh yeah.
And I actually, so I don't know why we went through this whole, you know, say, probably the same guy was still there, you
maybe,
know, even though
yeah.
this was 20 years ago now. But
he's apparently hitting the vapes.
Right.
Yeah.
But when they started saying, like, do you take this man? I started crying because I don't know why I didn't envision, like, having to take vows. I was thinking
in a basement.
In a basement. I just thought this was, like, you know, paperwork and they'd just be like, sign here, now go home. And I went to work that day. Like, I went. Work. I was at work by 9:30. Well, because we had a wedding coming, a real wedding coming later. I mean,
well, if HR is listening still, now you're back in their good books.
That's right. That's right. But you know, of course, like every not a lot of people who get married in the basement. I was pregnant, so you know, it's like an ulterior motive.
Gotcha. Our colleagues at Sun Times covered that Pilsen couple. Of course, they also covered newborns of the new year. My niece, she's a January 1st baby. Well, she's an adult now. But what's funny to me is that, I mean, even so many years later, it still takes me several hours into January 1st to remember, oh, right, got to reach out. Mm-hmm. Oh, got to get a gift. Like, because you're still recovering from New Year's Eve, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like any big holiday birthday. You feel kind of bad. I mean, I know
I feel
a couple,
so bad. For
I know
the,
a few Christmas babies.
Yeah.
They're like 30 now. But
you're
like,
getting two gifts in one.
Yeah. You know, you were never, the gift parity was never there. You know,
sorry,
even if
guys.
Your parents tried, you know, it wasn't there. But,
I'm
you know,
so
do you
sorry.
Think, do you think people plan, do you think people want to have a New Year's baby? Like, are they calculating
I
this?
Think some do. I think some do.
Yeah.
Of all the holidays to have on your birthday, one being shared with one that's associated with hangovers and like attempts at self-betterment.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what I want to be associated
that's
with.
That's not the one. That's not the one. All right, let's get into some news here, Alex. Plans to turn the old Rainforest Cafe in River North to a pot dispensary. They've gone up in smoke.
That's an excellent pun. Whoever thought of it. Very original. This would not be the first dispensary in River North. As we know, they've been popping up all over the place.
Yes, and you've been on the show quite a bit to talk about it because you cover cannabis.
Yeah, among other things, yeah.
And do you?
Yeah, so there were two, not vaping though. You could find a different vape correspondent. So these two companies called Progressive Treatment Solutions LLC and BioPharm, they had rolled out this plan to open a dispensary in the late lamented Rainforest Cafe in River North. It had basically just gotten, it went through zoning approval. It went to what's called the Zoning Board of Appeals, which is sort of just like a ministerial body that makes sure that they've checked all their boxes.
Mm-hmm.
They were sued by a competitor on the grounds that they had run afoul of a state regulation that they were too close, basically, to existing dispensaries, and by a neighbor who just didn't want more dispensaries in their neighborhood. And it turns out that they just gave up. They just said that they're going to scrap the plan.
So these lawsuits stop any cannabis company from moving in, or just these specific ones?
These specific ones, related to the distance requirement, which it draws attention to some pretty murky legal language. It's in the state law that says that no dispensary can open within 1,500 feet of another dispensary.
Mm.
Interestingly, the first two dispensaries in River North got around that by opening at the same time, on the same day. And so neither opened in, less
right.
than 1,500 feet from an existing dispensary.
Perfect.
And so it's a lot of murky language. There's a question here raised by this lawsuit of whether so-called social equity applicants are exempted from those rules. But, I mean, that's something that state attorneys are going to have to figure out maybe as they go back and if they update the law next. And bottom line, though, also, you know, if you are in need of legal expensive cannabis and you're in River North, you're not going to be without
you
options.
Know where to go.
Can I just say though that I am bummed. I mean, if they would have kept all the people, have you ever been into mm-hmm. the rainforest? I mean, there's like these like freaky like animals who like dance, and there's always like the sound of the rainforest coming, and it's like a really psychedelic place. I was like, this is the place that you need to go and get some weed. I mean, if they kept all the, I wanted them to keep everything.
All the stuff around.
All the stuff. And then you go in there and I really, they, but I guess not.
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news. It's going to be very cold next week.
A
Have you heard?
Storm.
Yes. A winter storm. Our first major winter storm is coming. Are you excited?
Yeah, bring it on.
I would be excited, but I have a feeling it's going to be a bust. I feel like,
yeah, me too.
You know. Like,
I hope you're right.
It actually is crazy that in Chicago we're hoping for snow these days. But the past couple of winters.
Right here. We speak French now?
I'm hoping for snow. I mean, I would rather have snow than just the interminable grayness has become our winters here, you know. So I'm hoping for snow. I hope it really dumps on us, but I'm also not getting my hopes up.
Whatever
it
doesn't
rain.
Bring the wind chill.
It's going to be
fine without the wind chill.
I think you're right.
It's going to be slush.
We talked winter hobbies on the show yesterday, Sarah, and part of that segment was so cool because one of our producers, Max Lubers, went out and talked to some of the fishermen here at Navy Pier.
Oh, yeah, I love seeing those guys.
Yeah, it was so cool. I mean, what's the earliest or latest you've seen them out there when you're coming to and from work?
In the morning?
Yeah, I mean, they're out there
early in the dark.
So
like,
early.
It's been dark, yeah.
And then it gets dark again when we're leaving because it's winter in Chicago.
Yeah.
They're still out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I should listen to that. I want to hear, but I keep thinking to myself, I just want to talk to those guys. Do they eat the fish? Do they eat the fish?
Yes.
Oh, that's
and
what I wanted
are they,
to know.
Are they paying for parking on Navy Pier?
No, I don't think so. Right, right. That's the big question.
No, just you.
Right. That's right.
All right. Real quick, around the table, anything that you're looking forward to working on in this new year? Big news threads that you're looking forward to diving into real quick.
I mean, with the migrant crisis, asylum seekers, where do we go from here? It's the biggest question of
the year. Question. I know election season is coming up. DNC for me, for sure. Alex?
Like 24 tax increment finance districts are expected to expire this year. And I need to know whether the city is going to try to expand them or not. I know it's on everyone's minds. It's all anyone
Absolutely. TIFFs. I go to sleep and I dream of TIFFs. What about you, Sarah?
For sure. Oh, this is the year that we will elect our first school board members.
Yippee! Wow.
So this is, I mean, this is a big deal. Yeah. It's never been done in the city of Chicago ever, ever.
Yeah, well, we'll leave it there. That's the weekly news recap, our first one for 2024. My thanks to WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp, Block Club Chicago reporter Quinn Myers, and Illinois Answers Project's Alex Nitkin. Have a great weekend, folks.
Thanks.
Thanks.
This episode of The Reset Pod was produced by Linnea Dominic, Landon Jones, Max Lubers, and Dan Tucker. And it was edited by Linnea and Meha Ahmed. Every Friday, Reset hosts a weekly news recap to catch you up on the news that you might have missed. And throughout the week, we go deep with experts and journalists to learn more about potential solutions to problems affecting residents. Now, you can check out our full catalog of interviews by heading over to wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Enjoy your weekend, and as always, thank you so much for listening.